My name's Charlie, but I am alcoholic. I'm truly grateful to be here. I'm one of these guys, I'm grateful to be anywhere, really. You know, if you drank the way I did, you know, just breathing is something that's pretty special. You know, my hopes for today is you'll spot the power of God somewhere in Charlie's story. Because I think the power of God's all over my story. I took my last drink at the VA hospital. I was hospitalized and had to have surgery. And I took my last drink on the third day of December 1988. Now, that's not my sobriety date. I had to smoke one more of them funny cigarettes. And the funny cigarette was on or about the 11th day of December 1988. And so I just recently celebrated 20 continuous years, which is fantastic. This time of year always reminds me of where I began. You know, I'm one of these guys, I fell in love with alcohol. I mean, the first time I touched it, it changed how I felt. You know, I spent my childhood being kind of, you know, just the square peg in the world around holes. I was just like the odd guy out. I just didn't feel like I fit. You know, I heard somebody say one time, and it's really my story. He says, you know, the first day of kindergarten, I was awkward and afraid and didn't know what to do and didn't know what to expect. And if there had been a bar there, I would have bellied up because I needed a drink. And truly, that's my story. There it is. You know, I heard one guy say my entire story in a sentence, and I thought it was so fantastic. He says, but you don't understand. I'm sensitive, and I don't suffer well. And, I mean, you know, how spot on is that? I mean, that's Charlie's entire story. I started life being a truly, truly sensitive. If you smile, my feelings will get hurt. And if you forget to smile, my feelings will get hurt. And if you walk by and don't glance my way, my feelings will get hurt. And if I bump right into you and you look right at me and smile, my feelings will get hurt. I have some method of doing this. And see, alcohol helped so much. Oh, God, it quieted a lot of these demons of mine down. It quieted them down. The only problem that I seem to have is I didn't drink quite right. I didn't know I didn't drink right, but I didn't drink quite right. Had a guy come through my home group one time, and he said a statement that I just loved. He says, you know, I think the alcoholic's wired backwards. And I laughed because, I know one alcoholic on the planet that's truly, truly wired backwards. See, you know, the average person, if they got drunk enough to puke in a shoe, they're going to stop drinking. Not me. We got to get another bottle. There's another shoe, right? And see, there's layers of me that respond differently. See, if, you know, a lot of people would drink enough to get caught drunk driving, and they would stop. They'd either stop the drinking, or they'd stop the driving, or they'd stop both. Not me. I'm going to switch from Ford to Chevy. Right? I'm going to keep the drinking. I'm going to keep the driving. I'm wired different than what the normal group seems to be wired like. And, you know, it took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to finally figure out the blessing. AA's wired backwards. It's wired backwards for people like me. You know, nowhere in my life have I been anywhere that they said, well, you want to keep it, then give it away. Well, how blasted backwards is that? And see, that's the way this deal seems to work for me. The harder I try to be part of this, the more that I try to give, the more that I get. The gifts that I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous are, you know, far beyond my wildest dream. Into my drinking, I had been homeless for quite a while. I wandered the streets of Salt Lake as a drunk and a panhandler. And, you know, I got a couple of layers of me that's real, real, real awful. I got this ability of mine where I can lower my standards and then adjust. And then lower them again and adjust and lower them again and adjust and lower them again. And so, you know, by the time I was a homeless drunk, I had adjusted to being a homeless drunk. Everything was fine in my world. You know, on the streets, nobody cried. And I truly believe we had a lot to cry about, but we didn't cry, we laughed. We laughed and we sang. And we did everything we could to cover up what it felt like to be homeless drunks. You know, we sang weird songs like, you know, we all live in a yellow bunch of weeds, right? And we sang songs about under the viaduct, you know, instead of the boardwalk, under the viaduct. That was our gang. Somebody nicknamed us the Motleys. We were kind of an odd group. We bothered people for money is what we did. We panhandled and we bothered people. And we got money and we drank it up. That was the whole series of my life. Panhandle and drink and then panhandle some more. And, you know, I got quite a blessing. God gave me a blessing in December of 1988. I got a huge infection in my leg. And I couldn't catch people to get the money. I smelled bad, looked bad. And so I had to get up on them real quick to get at the money because they were out walking me. And, you know, by that point in my life, I was what they call a seizure-prone alcoholic. If you treat your body with enough alcohol long enough and then you try to take it away, your body won't take it. It'll throw you in grand mal seizures. And grand mal seizures are scary. That's my experience. They're scary. They'll whoop your ass, guaranteed. Grand mal seizures changed how I thought about alcohol. Prior to the seizures, you know, I would drink down to the lowest form, be beer, vodka, or something. But after the seizures, there's a lot of alternate alcohol supplies out there. Things that a lot of people don't talk about drinking, but people on the streets drink. There's mouthwashes and there's rubbing alcohols. One of my dearest friends was a hairspray guy. He drank the hairsprays of the world. He related to me because I shared, you know, some of the weird stuff that I did at a meeting. And he related to me. He hooked up. Him and I were strange. And you know, and it's all right being strange. I spent a lot of time in that downtown park they call Pioneer Park. And this time of year reminds me of the park so much. Back in the 1980s, they used to have the Thunderbird wine you could get downtown. And they had them bright green bottles, you know, and Pioneer Park always looked like Christmas because there's the bright green bottles and all that red blood. And so it always seemed to look like Christmas to me down there because, you know, somebody was going to get beaned with a bottle and there's going to be blood somewhere and then green bottles and red blood. It was always Christmas. They did something weird in 1988. They decided they were going to try to stop us from panhandling. And so they took Thunderbird wine away from us. It was $1.65 a bottle back then. And the closest next low price thing was this pint of vodka, which was $2.35. And so the reality, we had to panhandle longer to get $2.35 than we did $1.65. And the bad news for the people on the streets was it ate them alive. You know, people went from this like 16-proof wine and started drinking 80-proof vodka. And oh my God, people walked out in front of cars, got run down. People blacked out and stabbed each other. I mean, it was crazy. It was crazy making. The city did remove the wine from us, but it didn't help. It made matters worse. In 1988, I got this infection in my leg, and I had to go to the hospital. And I'm a veteran. I went to the VA hospital. And I had managed to turn myself yellow by then. My liver was drunk. It wouldn't process my body fluids anymore. So the yellow from your urine kind of backs up. Your eyes turn yellow. Skin turns yellow. And it was a gift from God for Charlie. Because, you know, when these people kept telling me that I was starting to look better, I didn't know why I looked bad. And so I asked. They said, well, you're not as yellow today as you were yesterday. And so, you know, now I'm realizing I've drank enough to turn myself yellow. And I come up with this brilliant thought. You know, maybe I don't drink right. And see, that was a breakthrough for Charlie. That was the closest I got to any sort of sanity ever. Maybe I don't drink right. And so, you know, I had this weird kind of starting point. They kept asking me to go to this alcohol ward. It didn't make sense because I didn't believe people like me survive. I believe that, you know, by the time you get down to being seizure prone, our gang doesn't survive alcoholism. And so I kept turning it down because it didn't make any sense. Why take up a good bed for somebody that really needs it? You know, one of these guys that could get well, why should I be in that bed? That'll kill another veteran. And about that time, they says, well, we're going to let you go home and heal your leg. Now, the only thing that I had close to a home, there was an abandoned reefer trailer across the street from Pioneer Park. And some tramp had found a mattress, pulled it up in there. I lived there quite a while with another character, a guy named Rabbit. Rabbit smelled like a bear, but he was warm. He had a lot of gear, and I had a lot of gear. And we kept each other warm. We were staying alive and homeless in Salt Lake. And then Rabbit got the bright idea. He wanted to go south where it was warmer. He caught out. And he took most of the body heat with him. God, it was cold. And so when they told me I was going to heal my leg at home, there wasn't anywhere to heal my leg. I knew that it wouldn't take long. I'd get infection. I'd lose my leg. And so I went to this alcohol ward to save my leg. Nothing to do with alcoholism. And I sat there in this spin dry for about 30 days. I'm not sure quite what we did. I was pretty foggy. I was truly fogged up because I drank hard. And right at the end, they asked me how long I thought I'd stay sober once I left. And I estimated two and a half hours. And the guy asked me, he said, well, what would it take for you to stay sober longer? And I pondered that because I thought, whoa, me staying sober. Well, if you lock me in somewhere safe like this hospital for about a year, give me a head start, I might be able to do it. And at that point, they sent me to a place called First Step. I went to another treatment program. At First Step, I came to. I started to come to. The fog started to clear. But as soon as the fog cleared, I went crazy. You know, I don't know about you guys. I hear a lot of people tell, you know, when they stopped drinking, they got better. That's not my experience at all. I stopped drinking. I got worse. I got way, way, way worse. The only thing keeping me wired together was alcohol. You know, I heard a speaker one time say, thank God for drugs and alcohol. And I thought, boy, that's odd from an AA speaker. But his next sentence was, without them, I would have been swinging in the garage. And see, that's my story, too. Without alcohol, I probably would have blown my brains out years and years and years before. But alcohol got me through whatever I was trying to go through. I'm not sure what it was, but it sure felt terrible, I guess, because I needed to be numb so I didn't feel it. And so I stayed numb for a long, long process of time, very, very numb. You know, I started to get introduced to AA well before I ever got to the VA hospital. The one thing I love about AAs is they'll hunt you down. And you guys were hunting me down for a long, long time before I ever got here. My very first AA was a guy showed up to a jail cell. I was in jail in Davis County. And this little old gray-haired guy come there, and he brought Cokes. And my cellmate says, oh, you're going to go to AA? I said, well, I don't go to AA. He says, he's got Cokes. And so I went to my first AA meeting to get a Coke. You don't get Cokes in jail. And this little old gray-haired guy told me how I was helping him stay sober. And I thought, man, that's grand of me, helping this poor old alkie out. Now, I'm sitting in the jail cell having to do with my own drinking, driving behavior. But I can't connect the dots. I'm not quite ready. But the little old man did the grandest gift that an AA can do. He planted the seed. He planted the seed of hope for Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know the way a lot of these Alcoholics Anonymous seeds sprout, you pour whiskey on them. Right? I spent the next 10 years pouring whiskey on that seed, and by golly, that baby come up out of the ground. It sprouted. It sprouted for me. You know, I shared this story. I'm blessed because I get to go to our Metro jail. It's one of the grandest places. If you haven't gone to jail as an AA member to take a meeting, consider it. It's one of the most spiritual opportunities in AA. But I told this story about a year ago to my women's cell. I do a men's and a women's cell. And one of the gals says, and Charlie, you know, you're our little old gray-haired guy. And I laughed. See, the little old man had showed me everything I needed to know about staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You carry the message of hope. If you carry the message of hope, you're going to stay sober. That's what Bill Wilson figured out. Bill Wilson had this blinding flash in a hospital, and then because Ebby mentioned something about you've got to give it to somebody else, he says, hey, there's the answer. I've got to give this thing away. And of course, you know, Bill and he ran around trying to tell people how to get sober. Finally, Dr. Silkworth says, no, no, share your experience with them. And one of the first people he shared his experience with was a man called Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob could relate to him because he wasn't telling him nothing. He was sharing his experience. You know, and this became the foundation of this whole deal. A couple of drunks talking to each other. They had the biggest breakthrough right at the beginning, one of the most important things in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, right in the beginning. Dr. Bob got sober immediately. And the two of them sat around that kitchen table and talked about these grand spiritual matters. And then Dr. Bob went to the convention thing and came back drunk. And when he came back drunk, they got him sober again. And they realized, we cannot sit and talk about this deal. We got to get up and go do it. And see, that was the breakthrough of the whole deal. You know, if you read the big book, it'll talk about that. And it'll make the statement. It's the first word I ever underlined in the big book. It says, we knew that work with others was vital to our permanent recovery. I underlined the word vital twice. I thought, boy, that word sounds important. You know, vital to our permanent recovery. And so, you know, right in the introduction to the book, they're telling us what we got to do. We got to be active in this deal. You know, I've been so blessed with it. I wasn't ready for any of this. I was so angry. I just hated everybody and everything. And it was all about protecting Charlie. See, I really hated Charlie, but I couldn't go there. I wasn't ready to go there. I hated me because I hadn't lived by my values for decades. You know, I have grand values, and I wasn't busy living up to them. You know, I'm basically an honest man, but, you know, being a panhandling liar was not very close to that honesty value of mine. And so I truly hated me. And so the way I protected hating me is I hated you. I blamed you for it all. I was the most perfect racist when I got here. I hated every race, including mine. You know, and it made it real convenient because I could smear this anger away from me. I had a counselor that busted me. Oh, God, I hated her. And she says, well, Charlie, what is it you hate about yourself? And, of course, my always answer is, but, you don't understand. I don't hate me. And then she asked a dumb question. She said, then why did you force yourself to live that way? And I was stuck. I didn't have the answer to that. But I pondered it and pondered it and pondered it. And I came up with my average American dog story. Average American dog has a regular hygiene pattern, and I didn't have one. Average American dog's got a stable place to sleep, and I didn't have one. Average American dog has a regular diet, and I didn't have one. And so I had figured out as a homeless drunk how to treat myself below the average American dog. And so, you know, I had to look at that. That appears like I must hate Charlie if I'm going to treat myself at that level. And, you know, so I made myself a real commitment that I'm going to treat myself as good as the dog anyway. I'm going to eat regular. You know, I'm going to get me a regular place to sleep. And I'm going to hygiene. I'm going to wash myself. And see, these are all the improvements that I had to start with to get this deal. When I got to First Step, they gave me such a gift. They had a thing they called the First Step Railroad. And the way the First Step Railroad works, we'd need a chairman for next month's meeting. And somebody would say, well, I nominate Bill. And somebody else say, I move nomination ceased. And then everybody clap. And as soon as I got to First Step, I became a chairman real quick, the First Step Railroad. But it caused me to start to connect with you guys. It was a gift, another gift from God. I started to connect by trying to be a chairman of a meeting. And, you know, because I knew nothing really about AA at all, I did a poor job. I thought I did a real poor job. And so what we had a business meeting, we decided, you know, a bunch of us newcomers is not good help for other newcomers. And so we started going around AA trying to find somebody sound like they knew what they were talking about. And we started dragging them to First Step with us, bringing them down there to the house. We ended up with what turned out to be a great gift. Somebody invited a very attractive lady to come to First Step. And, of course, the First Step Railroad worked, and she became the chairperson. And it wasn't often that very many people would come to the First Step meeting, but all of a sudden, all 50 men would be there at that meeting. Well, it worked to change everything. You know, having that attractive female there worked to change everything. Our meeting grew to over 100 people there for a while. We really had a powerful, powerful meeting. It had to do with all of us running around AA, asking anybody, sounded like they knew what they were doing. Would you come and share it with us? We're new. And they did, because that's the way AA works. People do this stuff for free and for fun, which is the weird part. See, it says in my big book that my problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. It doesn't say alcohol's my problem. It says my problem, the root of my problem, is I'm a selfish, self-centered, self-seeking individual. Wow. See, if the problem was alcohol, then the solution would be don't drink, right? That'd be real simple. Don't drink. Problem's alcohol. If the problem is selfishness, well, then what could be the solution? You know, it says early in the book something about these men that are living on an altruistic plane. I read that altruistic word, got confused, didn't know what it meant, had to look it up. It means helping others. This group of men had figured out that helping others was an answer to a selfishness problem. Oh my, what a gift. What a gift. All I got to do is try to get outside of Charlie and I'll have a shot at this deal. How do I get outside of me? Well, let me try to carry the message. Let me go somewhere. Now, in my early starting point, oh God, I went through so many fascinating layers. Early on, I became an AA parrot. I don't know whether you guys have ever heard those. I became an AA parrot. I didn't know what any of the stuff meant, but I needed to echo it back to you. All right, one at a time. And I was stuck there. I didn't know what none of it meant, but I needed to echo it to you guys. It was real, real important. And then the next layer, as I started to read the book, I would have to get up here to the podiums and teach it to you. That was my next layer. I had needed to teach it to you because I'd read something in the book, and I had to get up and teach it to you. These are layers of how I had to do this deal. I heard a guy say it, and it's truly my story. He said he did that briefer AA method. He did the three steps. You know, I'm sick, I'm sorry, but I want to help. You know, that's how I started this deal. I was carrying the message to detox centers before I even knew what the hell the message was. But I had what they wanted, right? I had what those guys wanted. I had 30 days. Right? And so I was carrying a message of hope that I really didn't know what the message was, but it didn't matter. I was doing the deal to the best of my ability, carrying the message as proudly as I could, and it was saving my life. See, there's the real deal. It was saving Charlie's life by me doing this. And so I became a real going everywhere, all the treatment centers, detox centers. Early on in AA, I wasn't here for what you guys have, this sobriety thing. I wasn't. You know, after being homeless as long as I was, I hadn't hooked up with a lady for a long time. I came to AA over a gal. I was hoping to hook up with somebody. And there was a lot of ladies in AA, so I came looking for ladies. And the miracle was I sat and I heard what you guys talked about. I wasn't here to be sober. You know, the thought like that will never get stuck in my brain. The idea, let's stay sober all week, that'll never come out of Charlie's brain. If we talk about let's get trash, now that'll be one of mine. See, I know the difference, see? That's why, you know, I'm sober all this time, and it'll never make sense to me. Being sober will never make sense to me. It'll never come from my brain. You know, I'm willing to stay sober all day, this one day at a time thing you guys have taught me how to try. Why don't you just try to make it till bedtime, Charlie? Okay, I'll try that. And then get up tomorrow and see if you can make it till bedtime. Oh, yeah, I'll try that. You know, but the idea, why don't we stay sober for 20 years? I didn't sign up for 20 years when I got here. I didn't. I was hoping to make it till spring. I was sitting in a treatment center, and I was hoping to make it till spring when it got warmer. I was snowbirding. That's what they call it. A snowbird is where you just come in the winter and leave in the spring. And that's all I was after. AA's been such a gift to me. Oh, my. I got initiated to a wonderful group of people. We have a general service structure. And I got introduced to general service early on. I became the alternate GSR of the, it was the all-comers group at First Step House. And the reason I became the alternate GSR, because I was the third oldest member and the second oldest member got drunk. And so I had almost 6 months sobriety, and I became an alternate GSR. And I got to go to the very first conference, which was Skyline, 1989. I got to go to Skyline. And they went in there and they argued about stuff for about 9 hours, and then they'd table it. Then they'd argue about the next thing about another 9 hours, and then they'd table it. And they did this all day long. And I could not for the life of me see how this was going to help Alcoholics Anonymous or anybody in the room stay sober. I couldn't see it. I could not spot it from where I sat, and it truly upset me. And you got to remember, I started this deal as an angry man. And so I was angry about it. It was my starting point. Now the way General Services worked for me, it's the best ruler I've ever found in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, when I started out, oh God, I was angry. I could hardly sit in the room. I'd have to get up and leave and wander around, come back in, sit down, get pissed again, get up and leave, come back in, sit down again, get pissed, get up. And see, through the process of time, year after year, my response to a meeting in the general service structure has changed. Now I can sit and lovingly watch the people go through what I used to go through. I can sit lovingly, watch people get angry with each other. I can sit lovingly knowing that this is their process just like it was mine, that they are maturing in Alcoholics Anonymous. So my best yardstick is called general service because I get to measure how Charlie's doing in relationship to where I started. It's a great gift. A lot of people in general service are truly, truly dedicated to making sure this thing stays safe for the future. There was in one of our conference reports, there was one of the speakers, he made such a, what I thought was just a golden statement. He's at the conference and he's the keynote speaker, and he made the statement. He says, Alcoholics Anonymous is not about us staying sober tonight. We're here, we're all sober. Alcoholics Anonymous is not about that. Alcoholics Anonymous is about that child being born somewhere in the world tonight that is destined to walk down that path called alcoholism. And that's our responsibility because it's up to us to decide what that person's going to walk into. And we're going to do that by the way we design who we are, how we treat Alcoholics Anonymous, because we're going to design what the future of this deal really is. You know, and for me, gosh, what a wonderful responsibility. We have the responsibility for the future of mankind. What a gift. You know, I'm always amazed the way God worked this thing out. I swear, I think AA is part of his sense of humor. I've always thought that. I mean, you got to look at AA. We had a few new people here. And you notice what we did? We clapped if they knew their own first name, right? Where else in the world are you going to find a gang like ours? Really? Where else in the world are you going to find somebody that's willing to clap for an alky that knows their own name? See, these are the gifts of... And then you stop and you look at the way we do it. We set up a speaker, put a speaker up to talk about what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Well, crazy part, I'm a blackout drunk. I don't have a clue what the hell happened. If you want to know what happened, ask my neighbors, you know. They'll tell you what went on. I don't have a clue. You know, I was there, and then I was gone, and I was passed out, and then I was back. And then somebody said, you want to know what you did last night? And I screamed, hell no. I don't want to know. When I was in treatment, one of the guys said, wouldn't it be neat if somebody could hypnotize us so we could remember everything we lost in blackout? And I said, well, I don't want to be hypnotized. I'm not one of those. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that happened in my journey. A lot of stuff that I'm truly, truly so ashamed of. When I first got to AA, I believed that my ex-wife had kicked me out and took my kids away. See, all of this is nonsense. None of that's the truth. Truth is, I was a drunk. She protected those kids from the drunk. She asked me not to be drunk in front of them, and I chose to go get drunk. And I blamed her for me being drunk. So I drank at her for quite a while, and then, you know, if you shook the way I shook, then you had to drink at your own drinking to deal with the drinking you did yesterday. You had to drink at your drinking, and then, of course, then you got drunker, and then you did some more crazy crap. Then you had to drink at that. The problems piled up. You know, I heard a guy say it, and it's my story. He says, you know, his whole life was like riding around in a station wagon car. You get married and throw it in the back, get some kids, throw them in the back, get divorced, throw it in the back, get some bills, throw it in the back. In recovery, it's like you hit the brick wall, and everything rolls up in the front. And see, that's my experience. That's how I started this deal. I was so overwhelmed. Oh, my God. There was no way I could deal with it, and I was freaked out. And somebody gave me a wonderful gift. They says, why don't you imagine a closet and put it all in there and shut the door? Wow, what a gift. I put it all in there and I shut the door. And then they says, you know, you can't keep the door shut. You got to go to the closet every day. You got to get three things out. You got to address at least one of them. And so that's what I had to do, is I had to start going to the closet every day and getting three things out that I need to address, and addressing one, if I could, I had to do at least one. And some days I got all three. Some days I got to go back to the closet. Some days one was as good as a God. But I had to keep addressing this stuff, because this is a process, we call recovery. Yeah, I'm so grateful for this deal. You know, my life has changed so dramatically. You know, it talks in the big book about a complete psychic change. I think that happened to Charlie. You know, I seem to wander around preferring to be sober than wanting to be drunk. I don't want to be drunk, which is really odd, because my brain likes the idea of drunk. And you know, I'm wandering around being sober, which is truly a gift from God. It's nothing Charlie did. I was given the grace of bright yellow. That's the grace of God. And I was given the grace of an infection in my leg. That's the grace of God. I was given a bed in a treatment center. That's the grace of God. I was railroaded into AA service. That's the grace of God. You know, and then because I've been hanging around doing this deal, I've been given so many gifts. I got to share this one, because this group's one of the right places for me to share this story. A few years ago at the Metro Jail, maybe 2 years ago, we had in my women's pod, we had a pretty good-sized gal, heavy, beefy kind of gal, come in, and she was so angry. Oh, God, she was angry. And she wouldn't talk, but she would sit there and be pissed. And, you know, of course, my job is smuggling big books. You know, they allow us to stamp them and bring them in. We brought her a big book, and she came to the meeting every week, and she listened, and she listened. And then pretty quick, when she finally started talking, she was talking about stuff that was in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we watched this big ball of anger, she was so pissed, get softer and softer and softer and softer. She was with me a long time. When she did start talking, she said she had some pretty terrible charges and it was going to take a while to go to trial. And she never wanted to be the chairman, never wanted to be the chairman. I always look for a chairman when I get there. And one day, we got in there, and I says, who would like to be the chairman? She says, oh, I would. So gave her the thing. And she started the sharing, talking about she went to court that week, and she had five charges, and each of the charges were five to life. She had five charges of five to life, and somehow in the process of the week, they dropped three of them. And so she only had two charges, five to life. And the topic of tonight's meeting is going to be on gratitude. Now, I don't work this deal anywhere near that grand, but I got to sit in the room and experience the topic being gratitude following only having two charges, five to life. See, my world's made up of luxury problems. You know, what color are the drapes going to be, right? Should I put the gas in tonight or tomorrow? Right? I've got luxury problems. I don't have any real problems. Now, as she finally got sentenced, she got sentenced to go to prison. And the last meeting that we had before she went to prison, she cried all the way through the meeting, and I cried all the way through the meeting. I'm truly a softie when it comes down to it. And so we blubbered and blew snot, and the end of the meeting, she stood up and she says, "Charlie, I need you to promise me one thing." And I says, "What's that?" And she says, "I need you to go thank Alcoholics Anonymous for setting me free before I went to prison." And see, that's what you guys do. You set people free. You set people free through your efforts, through your 12-step stuff, from sticking a buck in a pink can, you know, putting a buck in the basket, showing up when somebody needs help. That's what you guys do. You set people free. And she made me promise, and, you know, this is the second place I've got to actually tell this. I got to tell it at our assembly this past year. Got to tell the assembly thank you from her. I haven't heard from her. She promised she'd write. She never did. Hope she's all right in prison. I don't know if she'll ever get out or never get out. But either way, I'm not afraid for her because she's got the power of Alcoholics Anonymous living in her life, which is the biggest mother load of this whole deal. You know, there's a power in Alcoholics Anonymous that just amazes me. I don't know what it is. I haven't got a clue what it is, but I know we've got it. Whatever it is, we've got it. Because we have this ability to transform lives with simple drunken stories. Go figure. Now, is that God's sense of humor or what? Right? For one drunk to be able to talk to another drunk and the second drunk get well is an amazing piece of information. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, look at, you know, God could have picked anybody on this planet. He could have picked the highly educated, but he didn't. He could have picked all spiritual people, all them ministers and stuff, but he didn't. He picked the garden variety drunk to help others. And then he gave us this gift of healing. You know, one alcoholic sharing with another. That's how this whole deal began, Bill and Bob. You know, Bob offered him 5 minutes or something, and then 4.5 hours later, he left. But he finally found somebody that knew what he was talking about. He was talking about his own alcoholism. He was talking about his experience. I come to AA because God hangs out here. That's why I come. Because I can feel God in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can feel God. That's why I go to jail. You know why I go to jail? Because God hangs out there. If you want to see the power of God, come sit in a jail cell. Holy. It's so amazing. Especially, you know, if you get a group that's stuck in there for a while, you get to watch them change right before your eyes. And there's nothing grander than watching their light get brighter and brighter and brighter. And hear them anticipating you coming for the meeting. You see, the craziest thing about our metro jail, we have permission to have a panel of 20, meaning 20 AAs can come in there. You know, we've never filled that panel of 20. We don't have 20 members of Alcoholics Anonymous willing to go to jail. I mean, that blows my mind away. I mean, to me, it's one of the biggest gifts going. Go to metro jail. You know, I get to go on Sundays. Back when it was the old metro, we had the name Slammers. And because I didn't like the new name, I got my group to change the name back to Slammers. I'm part of the Sunday Slammers meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meets every Sunday at Metro Jail, ADC. One meeting's at 6 and one is at 7:15. I get a men's and a ladies pod, and they give me the wealth of Alcoholics Anonymous week after week after week. It's the greatest, one of the greatest things I get to do. Yeah, I'm truly grateful that you guys allowed me to ramble on. I think I've pretty well eaten up most of the time. I hope you spot God somewhere in Charlie's story, because he's everywhere. You know, I'm one of the luckiest guys. I remember the day that I went to VA hospital, I had this idiot ask me, he was a psychiatrist. They says, "Well, we're thinking of hospitalizing you." And I said, "Well, you got to give me Librium. I'm a seizure-prone alcoholic." And they said, "Well, we don't do that here." And, you know, I thought, well, that's kind of odd. So I started putting all my clothes back on. And you're homeless. You put on layers and layers and layers to stay warm. I was putting my layers back on. The guy said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I got to go downtown. He said, why? I said, well, I got to get a drink. He said, well, we're going to hospitalize you. I said, well, I'm not going to do grand mal seizures for you guys' entertainment. I'm not willing to do that. You can either give me some Librium and get me below them seizures, or I can't stay. I have to drink. And so he called for the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist come to see me. The guy asked me the stupidest question I'd ever heard. He says, how much do you drink? And I thought, well, what a dumb question. I drink all of it. And he, you know, it kind of pissed him off. He didn't think it was so funny. He said, no, how much do you drink? And I thought, well, didn't you listen? I drink all of it. And we did this about four or five times, and then he's really getting all pissed off. And he says, no, I need to know how much you drink. And so I told him a piece of a day of my life. I said, I come to. And sometimes I got a bottle near me, and I drink it, and sometimes I don't. And sometimes I got money in my pocket, and sometimes I don't. But after I come to, I go panhandle, and I get some money, and I get a drink, and we drink it. And sometimes I pass out, and sometimes I stay up and get another bottle. And sometimes I pass out three or four times a day, and sometimes I don't pass out at all day. And everything I get my hands on, I drink. And you want me to count them too? Right? Now, I got to tell you about God's grace. You know what I do for a living? There came a job available at the Veterans Hospital for an alcohol counselor. I'd gone back to school to become an alcohol counselor because I worked with some of my deaf friends, and they didn't have a deaf counselor. I'd fiddled with their language, and I figured I was going to be a stopgap to help my deaf friends out. And so I got to the VA hospital, and they hired me. And you know what I do for a living? People come in, sit down in front of me, and I say, well, how much do you drink? See, you know, God has figured out what to do with Charlie. Now, I'm a true believer in the third step. I am a true believer in the third step. I think there ought to be a warning label on it. Because the moment that you tell God, I offer myself to thee to do with me and build with me, get ready for the ride of your life. That's my experience. If you humbly do this third step, offer yourself to God, get ready to turn a corner, because your life's liable to shift. That's my experience. You know, I'm just grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The most important thing that I've ever established in my entire life is I'm in good standing. That means I haven't drank all day. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. That may be the highest level of accomplishment I ever get, because that's the one that I'm by far the most proud of. When I celebrated 10 years, my kids made a big deal of it. They got a cake. And my younger daughter wrote me this birthday card. And on the birthday card, she wrote the words, I'm starting to believe you really mean it. Whoa, is that the honesty coming from your child? At 10 years sober, I had not convinced my daughter that I was committed to my own abstinence. She still didn't believe. And so, you know, coming up on my 20th anniversary, I've been bantering her for, four or five years now, saying, I can't wait for 20, see what the card says. This year, she had a friend of hers engrave the Serenity Prayer, gave me this plaque with the Serenity Prayer, and on the back, she wrote a couple nice things about her dad, and then in parenthesis, she wrote, I believe you mean it. And so, you know, I'm strutting around thinking I'm all something now, right? I said, so you mean you trust me? She said, I didn't say I trust you, Dad. She says, I believe that you mean it, that you're staying sober. I believe you mean it. She says, I'm still going to keep my eye on you. Thank you all for putting up with me. You know, you've truly healed me with your wonderful laughter. You know, I hope I shook a tear to somebody's eye somewhere in here. Thanks.